that's coming around now, this is finance or financial derivatives and all that stuff, is something to try and corral me and try and keep me down to an hour on derivatives. What I'm encouraging you to focus on with financial derivatives, which is our focus today, of course, is what are the benefits and particularly the shortcomings with the way in which derivatives are documented, okay? So we're not having to understand and love the whole of financial derivatives and what's an interest rate swap and all that kind of stuff in detail. We're focusing on how does the law treat them. So I'm going to carry on with the pack that I gave out last time, which is on Blackboard. I've run out of them, I'm afraid. About some of the standard market documentation, some of the problems with it. And then we'll remind ourselves a bit later on about credit default swaps and securitisation and the role all of that played in the financial crisis. Okay? So that's where we're going to end up, really. And come kind of full circle to, oh my God, what's going on? So the benefits and shortcomings on the sheet that I've just put out now. The benefits, this is to rehearse things I said last time, but let's revise. The benefits of the way in which derivatives are documented using the ISDA scheme, the International Swaps and Derivatives Association scheme, is that we were supposed to commoditise risks. By using standard market documentation, the idea was that we would all have the same risks in the same legal form. So instead of everyone doing their own thing in their own contract, at least we'd all be doing it the same way. So if there was a problem, we could all know how the marketplace was going to function, how it would react. That's the theory. Okay. And the aim, specifically, of the ISDA documentation, I think was really twofold. The politics in the background was the derivatives market saying, let's set up our own self-regulatory trade association, basically, so that we don't get regulated. So when we looked at those Love of Money documentaries, we saw a lot of discussion there about these things weren't regulated. Why weren't people regulating these derivatives, particularly credit default swaps? Why were they just allowed to flourish on their own in a corner like mushrooms in the dark, you know? Why weren't we regulating them? And this was part of the idea behind ISDA. Yeah, leave us alone, don't regulate us. We will organise something ourselves, it will all be alright. And when Alan Greenspan was running the ship, you know, everyone thought that was good. Remember, it was Greenspan who was trying to stop other bodies in the US from getting in there and regulating the derivatives market and getting in its way, because it was growing beautifully and growing naturally, yeah, like any baby might. So let's encourage that growth. And so what ISDA was then supposed to do in terms of its legal documentation, that's the background politics. The other thing that ISDA was aimed at then was providing default terms so we know what everyone's going to do in the marketplace. At least you can just sign up to a standard ISDA master agreement. And those default terms were primarily organised to get banks out of transactions. Because the assumption was when the first master agreement was put together in 1987 by ISDA, when it was known as the International Swaps Dealers Association, it changed its name but not its acronym. The idea was, somewhat outrageously, that you could, as a bank, say, only our customer will be bound by these terms, so that if they default, we're entitled to terminate the transaction, whereas we aren't so liable. And that was known as one-way liability. So if something goes wrong, only they are required to pay us, what was known as one-way payments. And outrageous. The assumption was that the banks were brilliant, the banks were safe, nothing would ever go wrong with the banks. It was only the customers, yeah? Those pesky corporate entities that make things and sell them, they're the ones that are going to go bust, so we need to be protected against them. Okay? When we have the second edition of this document in 1992, everyone has started to say, that's not going to work in insolvency law. If you simply say only the customer is required to pay to the bank in the event of something going wrong, if it's insolvency, that's not going to work. Because any insolvency law system will say you've both got to pay each other or set off against each other. So that's why they changed the document in 1992.
The version that we're looking at the minute is the 2002 edition, which was a slight change to the 1992 edition, to take account of 9/11, basically. I think they wanted to make a statement and do something to memorialise. So they put some provisions in there about effectively a material adverse change. What if something happens, like an aeroplane flying into a building, can we terminate the transaction? And so they updated it in a very small way, and a few typos were taken out and things like that. So this is said to be the benefit. Same terms for everyone. It provides default terms, so we've got some terms there if nothing else. It lets us exit transactions. It was hoped that it would be flexible enough to cope with new products, by which we mean it is bland and anodyne enough to cope with any new development. Two issues flow out of that, I think. Number one, it's drafted by committee, as I said last time, and therefore it's slightly ugly. It's a consensus position between all those lawyers and all those financial institutions. It's not anybody's perfect world, it's a consensus. I'm going to see this film, I'm going to see that film, I'm happy to say, let's go and see the Sandra Bullock one instead, you know? A compromise. It was also hoped that if new derivatives were developed in the marketplace in the future, that this standard bland document could be adapted to cope with them. And the fourth bullet point, and what ISDA does is it publishes definitions handbooks, and they get updated every once in a while as marketplaces develop, as we start to use new jargon, as the products change. ISDA every few years will update the definitions of what's meant by a swap, what's meant by payment obligations and all those sorts of things. So the idea was that ISDA Master can stay pretty much the same, and it has been pretty much the same since 87. Some of us born since 87? We might well be younger than the ISDA Master Agreement. How does that feel? It just seems weird to me. I may feel very, very old. Thanks. So this is the way in which we try and sort of modernise and keep up. Because the problem is, this is an innovative, moving marketplace. And credit derivatives are the best example of this. Credit default swaps developing really late. You know, if you read Julian's textbook, developing quietly in a corner in some particular banks. And then, you know, after they've been around for a few years, other people in other areas thinking, oh, in the mortgage area, why can't we use that to try and insure against some of the risk of loss, basically? So there are always new products being developed or used in new ways. And so the idea is to be flexible. Now, some of these shortcomings we've talked about. Talked last time about the fact that the documentation in practice is rarely completed. The pace at which derivatives markets move mean that typically individual transactions will mature and be finished before there's ever any kind of contract in place. So that's not a legal problem, if you like, it's a practical problem of having, you know, too complex documentation for it actually to be signed and settled. It doesn't seem to suit the marketplace in that way. So we can have binding contracts, as you know, because you've done contract law, yes. Offer and acceptance, we can do all that verbally, it'll be consideration. That can be done on the phone by the traders yelling at one another, that's absolutely fine. That can be a contract. The issue is, what if the traders don't discuss all of the detailed terms? What if they discuss who's going to pay how much to whom for how long? But they don't get down to specifics like, which system of law will govern this? Is it going to be French law that's governing law, English law? Where will we sue one another? Yeah, if you're acting a French bank in Paris with a German bank in Frankfurt and you've compromised on using English law, does that mean you're going to come and sue in London? Does that mean you're going to sue in Frankfurt? Those kind of things lawyers would think to sort out wouldn't necessarily occur to a trader. Are there tax problems? Are there other problems of French law that you need to think about? So, part of the problem with this, over the phone you can create a contract in theory, but the things that tend to be problems are things that only lawyers would think about, and therefore that aren't necessarily going to be resolved by the traders. So one of two things happens in practice. Either you try and agree after a lot of negotiation that all of your contracts will be subject to a specific type of confirmation contract. We will assume, if we don't agree anything to the contrary, that these will always be our contractual terms. That's what we do sometimes. Yeah, some of the big institutions, I remember when I was doing this kind of stuff, you'd say, this is just ridiculous, we've got so many trades outstanding, it's scary, let's at least agree on a standard form of words.
And that might take a year in itself, but it'd be worth it in a long time. Lightning. Ooh.
How exciting, how thrilling, as you talk about the end of the financial world. Yes, God is with us.
If she's up there.
There's usually sirens I've got to scream over. Look, the coppers have all stayed indoors now, the thunder's out. They don't like getting wet. So we've got that. The problem with that is, of course, you have a standard form of documentation. What if you don't anticipate, or your traders don't spot, that this one transaction has something funny about it? This is all innovative in this marketplace. We're always trying to do new things. That's where the money and the growth is. So what if you do something new, the traders don't realise that's different legally? It's got a different tax effect, or now we're booking this to a different office, we can't rely on English Shore anymore, or whatever it may be. Suddenly then you've got a contract that doesn't work. So there's the danger in using standard terms all the time. Or you do it the other way and say, well, the lawyers have got to draft the contract every time we trade, which comes back to the same problem. There's such a volume of work, will you ever get that done? And you end up, as we said before, I'll email you my terms, you email me your terms, and all we've then shown is that we've got a complete non-meeting of minds. If yours says we're going to do this under French law, and mine says we're going to do it under English law, that just shows we haven't agreed which system of law we're going to use, yeah, which creates a whole legal problem in itself. So there's a documentation we've been committing, that's one of the practical problems. It's focused almost entirely on bankruptcy, this delightful document, the Mr. Master Agreement. Have we got them with us? I'm just asking. Yes, some nodding, about three people nodding, everyone else did. No. Got what with us? Will this work today? Come on, there's thunder. Will you come on? It's going to be fun listening to this on the tape. We're now waiting for the screen to come on. Oh, you don't swear, Alistair. It's the last one. Just breathe deeply. The definition of bankruptcy, for those of us that have got this, is the longest thing in this document. So, this is all upside down, the way I've got mine. Where's it gone? God, I used to know this thing off by heart. Section 5A, and where is it? Oh, is the photocopying gone radio rental? Oh, you swine. Oh, it's failed. Mine hasn't photocopied half the pages. Oh, for God's sake. That's not going to work, is it? Swipe. The longest definition, we don't need to look at it in detail, it'd be nice if we could. The longest definition is the definition of bankruptcy. I think the photocopy, having asked to get the photocopying done, my copy jumps from page 6-9, where is it? 689 in my book. 691. It goes from 685 to 688, so there's a couple of vital pages missing. Brilliant. Sorry. So someone's done when the photocopying's been done, the copy is, it was having a real fit last week, so she's not done it. Apologies. I'll get that put up onto Blackboard, I'll find a way of doing that. The bankruptcy provision, this might as well go off. The bankruptcy provision is the longest provision, and what it does, trust me, and I think I probably reproduce a lot of it in your textbook actually, is to try and define every possible kind of bankruptcy. Not just you actually going bankrupt, you're going into receivership or liquidation or insolvency. And not just you actually going into insolvency, but even someone just serving a petition of bankruptcy against you. Or you saying in correspondence that you fear you may not be able to pay your debts as they become due. Something even that vague. And it spends about a page trying to define what bankruptcy means, because it's the central provision. Because all the document is really concerned about is what happens if one of us go bankrupt, particularly any corporate customer out there in the world. How do we make sure we, the bank, get out of this transaction with all our money? Okay? That's what it's all focused on. Brilliant. Yes, bankruptcy. The irony, as we talked about last time, is then that we define that in huge detail,
And yet the whole point of this document is supposed to be to ensure that we are able to have set-off on insolvency. As we talked about last time, if I go insolvent and I owe you a lot of money and you owe me money reciprocally, what we can do under English law, under Rule 490, as we'll come to in a second, of the insolvency rules, is that we can set off. Okay? In fact, if we just have a look at that now, why don't we do that? Take your mind off the thunder and how wet you're going to be going home. Page 121 in your hymnals, because apparently you're not allowed to have all the derivatives documents. Rule 490 of the Insolvency Rules 1986 is a statutory instrument covering insolvency. This rule applies where, before the company goes into liquidation, there have been mutual credits, mutual debts, or other mutual dealings between the company and any creditor of the company proving or claiming to prove for a debt in the liquidation. So if a company is being liquidated, there must be mutual debts between the parties, okay? Meaning amounts that are owed reciprocally. And this is why in the ISDA document that you talked about last time, there is a provision to say everything is treated as being a single agreement. Yeah? The master agreement, all the confirmations of each individual trade, and any guarantees and other credit support documents, we'll talk about that more in a second, they're all treated as being one single contract, because under Rule 490 and similar provisions, that entitles you to have mutual debts. All of the payments that are owed under all of your derivatives, potentially thousands of them, are reciprocal. That's the aim of that contract. Meaning, if one of you goes bankrupt, instead of me being the bankrupt person, therefore not being allowed to pay you anything, because I'm now bankrupt, and you being required to keep paying me, because you've got a contract to say you've got to pay me, that's a huge loss for you. You're not getting anything from me, you're having to pay me everything. Instead, we can set off those amounts. You can subtract everything I owe you from the things you owe me, which reduces massively the amount you have to pay me. Or if I owe you the surplus, I can't pay you anything because I'm bankrupt, but at least that's a much smaller amount that you're owed. Okay, so in terms of the losses you put on your accounts, that's much less than it would otherwise be. So that's the whole purpose of the ISDA Master, is to ensure that we're able to do that. And yet, as the ISDA Master was originally drafted, it had no close-out netting provision in it at all, because the ISDA committees couldn't agree. So in terms of reducing risk out there in the marketplace, this ISDA contract, which is supposed to be about organising risk and reducing risk, the key risk it could see, systemic risk, that someone would go bankrupt and that would suck everyone else down, wasn't even catered for in the contract. Which just shows the shortcoming of trying to get the market to regulate itself and come up with a form of language. Even when it sees that as being the nuclear problem, it couldn't figure out a way, a form of language of solving it, because it wasn't sure how the law worked. In the UK, you've got Steen and Blake there on the handout, BCCI number 8. Lord Hoffman tells us in BCCI number 8, also known confusingly as Morris and Rayners in some reports, that when the conditions of the Rule 490 are satisfied, a set-off is treated as having taken place automatically on the bankruptcy date. The original claims are extinguished and only the net balance remains owing one way or the other, following Steen and Blake, two House of Lords decisions. So 490 becomes mandatory. It's not a question of can you set off, it's a question in this jurisdiction that you must set off. So the sensible commercial view we've taken in this jurisdiction is to reduce the size of everyone's losses and debts to one another, we have to set off. Some other insolvency jurisdictions take the exact opposite approach. The insolvent person becomes frozen, they don't make any payments but they're entitled, they're liquidated to recover everything that's owed to them. And so the market much prefers the way we do it, because we reduce the size of the potential losses. The effect is to allow the debt which the insolvent company owes to the creditor to be used as security for its debt to him. The creditor is exposed to insolvency risk only for the net balance, the small surplus. The appellant cannot manufacture a set-off by directing that the deposit be applied to discharge someone else's debt, even though it may, as between itself and the debtor, have a right to do so. This is the very type of arrangement which the House declared ineffective in British Eagle. What you can't do, however, and you'll know this, those of you who are doing company law, is if we have Goldman 1 dealing with Morgan 1, and then we have another subsidiary in the Morgan Group, let's call them Morgan 2, where Morgan 2 has debts outstanding with Goldman 1, and Morgan 1 has debts outstanding with Goldman 1. If we only have a contract, a document in place between Morgan 1 and Goldman 1, you can't set off amounts owed between Goldman 1 and Morgan 2, because that's a different company. Those of us doing company law will know this is the Salomon principle. Even companies within a group of companies are distinct legal persons.
So what Lord Hoffman is telling us there with that second paragraph in the quote is that unless you have a contract in place between the two legal persons, the two companies, you can't have set-off. So you can't bring in third parties, other subsidiary companies, into this set-off unless you have contracts in place. So that's a huge part of the risk in these markets of not having documentation in place. It's not just having Goldman and JP Morgan having a contract between them. It's each subsidiary in each of those jurisdictions have to have contracts in place between them. Yeah. And the speed at which banks develop and use new subsidiaries all the time means that often that kind of documentation just isn't done in place quickly enough. So there's a huge job of work just doing that, as though there are 27 hours in the day in which all that kind of stuff could be done. So Lord Hoffman has solved a lot of the problems for us, a lot of the concerns about closeout netting in this jurisdiction. We know it works, but only if there's a contract in place between those parties, which is why documentation being rarely completed is still a real problem. Insolvency is what we're trying to solve here, but unless we've got contracts in place, it can't be. Representations I talked about last time. The representation problems, which you do have in your handout, apologies. I say all this stuff is discussed in the chapters 43 and on that I refer to in your seminar materials. I give you very specific reading from the derivatives chapters in your textbook, so it's all in there anyway. The representation provisions in ISDA say you represent that you have the capacity to create this contract. The logical problem with that is if you don't have the capacity to create the contract, then you don't create a valid contract. And ISDA just hasn't got round that problem at all. They just assume that because that term in section 3 of the ISDA agreement says you represent you have capacity, that that solves the problem. It doesn't at all. As we saw in Mr. Deutschland's mechanisms, if there is no valid contract in place, the court will ignore your contract completely. No matter how beautifully drafted it is, no matter how long it is, that you've signed it all, that you had a fabulous lunch afterwards, yeah, you had a big signing drinks party, you know, doesn't matter. Your contract will be void according to English law. None of its terms will be relied upon by the court. And like Westdeutsche Landesbankenesingen, the court will simply go back to the general law to decide whether or not you're entitled to recover amounts that are owed to you. So that's a real problem. What do we do if the contract doesn't work? Which brings me to problems with the credit support deed, so called. This is a whole topic in itself, which you're just not going to be able to give in proper detail. So-called collateralisation. The way in which the market typically seeks protection in the derivatives we're talking about, the so-called over-the-counter derivatives markets, the things that are done off-exchange, so there's no exchange in place here, is a very simple idea whereby it started out as trusts back in the mid-90s. If I'm dealing with you, you're dealing with me, we've got derivatives. As we said last time, the exposure we have to one another is constantly being calculated by reference to mathematical models. What we're doing is we're valuing today, over the 10-year life of our interest rate swap, for example, over those 10 years, what's the probability that you're going to owe me money, as opposed to me owing you money, given current market rates and our expectations about the future? So what's the value, we think, of that product today, given our estimates as to where we're going to go out in the future? And as market movements throw up and down, what we expect is going to happen 10 years down the line also changes. So day to day, our guess as to the value of that interest rate swap, for example, changes. So this is all the maths we were talking about. These mathematicians that build these models to estimate these things. We're entirely reliant on the mathematical models there for what the value of things is. So that means day to day, our exposure to one another across all of our derivatives business can change. It can change because some of we can create new contracts, which will create new exposures. Old contracts might be terminated. They might simply expire. So that will get rid of old exposures.
But also, as we value these things as being more or less valuable to us, the exposures change day to day as well. It's constant movement of guesses as to how much it's worth. Banks become incredibly complicated. People whose job is entirely just to oversee where these trades are, where the markets are, and to keep calculating. Are we in profit? Are we in loss? What should we do? What are our losses? Because then we have to go and hedge that, remember, as we were talking last time. We need to go and buy protection against that by buying yet more derivatives. The assumption being the maths can remove all of these risks. This we talked about last time. So what we do in the marketplace now is to say, if I owe you money on our guess as to what we think our derivatives are worth today, and there could be thousands of these deals in existence at once, so we're looking across all those deals, what's the net balance? I will pay you money equal to the amount of that exposure. Okay? That's the theory. Now, in the old days, what used to happen was, I would pass that to a trustee, and the trustee would hold that money. Or often in the marketplace, we would use bonds, actually, for this. Instead of cash, if you had securities or bonds lying around, you would deposit a given amount of bonds with a trustee, and the trustee would hold them on trust, so that if you failed to make payments, those bonds would be passed to your counterparty, and they would use that to set off the loss they would suffer as a result of you not paying. Okay, so this is the theory. After a while, we began to realise it was very difficult and cumbersome to actually hold bonds physically on trust, because we had to segregate them, we needed a proper trustee, the whole of trusts law came in. Also, there were lots of problems about how do you have certainty of subject matter over bonds that are intangible. How can we segregate one bond from another bond when they're intangible? This created huge problems, theoretically, in law. So we stopped using trusts, and instead we just ran another account. I said, well, I will just transfer you money. Let's go back to money. And the collateralisation is just a process then of calculating our exposures day to day, and how much money do I have to keep paying you in this account, or if the exposure falls, you pay me some money back. Collateralisation. Now, the credit support deed and the credit support annex are two documents created by ISDA. And again, standard documents, they're giving standard models out to the marketplace and saying, use these. Because this is how we're supposed to take security and derivatives. Rather than using old-fashioned mortgages or trusts or anything else, we're supposed to use collateralisation, which the bankers like because it's all about maths, calculating exposures and moving assets around. You can either decide with the annex, the ISDA credit support annex, that you don't want to take what they call security interests in any particular assets. A security interest being, I would suggest, an Americanism used by some English commercial lawyers to suggest some right in some asset that you can use to secure your liabilities. As a property lawyer, that makes me want to vomit. What does it mean? Does that mean a trust? Does that mean a mortgage? Does that mean a charge? Does that mean I own it? Does that mean I can fondle it? Can I touch it? Can I take it out to dinner? What does that mean? So if you don't want a security interest, okay, you would use the annex. Because the annex says, instead of taking property rights in assets, you would instead simply transfer money equal to the amount of the exposure that you owe to the other party or that they owe to you on any particular day. The other reason why we think this is a good idea, because it gives you some protection, is that there's something called the EC Collateral Directive, which says, in effect, that if you have this kind of structure in place, remember the Basel II Accord says banks have got to set aside regulatory capital equal to their exposures to given markets? If you have one of these collateral structures in place, the directive says, you can use that to set off against the amount of regulatory capital you need to hold. So by running these accounts between banks, they reduce their capital costs. There is something called the credit support deed, however, for those of us who do want a, quote, security interest. Yes, if you're an old-fashioned lawyer and you want to have something which is there to secure your rights under your contract in case your counterparty doesn't pay, so where you do want a security interest, you use something called the credit support deed. As on the bit of paper I handed you out on that bullet point, the credit support deed, which I bet is not photocopied in the handout either, I'm not going to look. The credit support deed provides, one of its key provisions, I discussed this in the textbook, that the parties mortgage, charge and pledge that certain assets will be transferred between each other as their exposure changes. They mortgage, charge and pledge. A mortgage, charged by way of legal mortgage, as you've studied this when you did this in Law of Property 1 all that time ago. Yeah? Remember, that was one of your first lectures, this is your last.
How exciting. Choked up slightly.
Says that you acquire a proprietary right in the mortgaged property. Yeah? A charge, however, strictly put, does not acquire you a proprietary right in anything. An equitable charge simply gives you a right to petition the court to ask for permission to seize the property. It's no more than a contingent interest. It's a mere space. You hope the court will grant you that right. You have no entitlement to it. A pledge, when you pledge something at a pawnbroker, for example, that's a mere possessory right. Yeah. I have this thing physically under the terms of our contract, you know, unless you come back and redeem it, basically. It's a possessory right to pledge. It's not a right of ownership. So how, in the name of all that is holy, and right and proper and plump and fluffy and good, can you mortgage and charge and pledge the same thing? It is a legal impossibility. This is an apple and a pear and a banana. No, it's not. You're insane. Get off this bus. You can't mortgage and charge and pledge the same thing. And Isda is just stuffed with those kind of, what? Now, this is a committee thinking, should we have a mortgage? No, I want a charge. I want a mortgage. Mortgage, you might have to register something. Let's have a charge. Oh, I want a pledge. I like pledges. What does a pledge mean? I don't know. Isn't that what you clean wood with, pledge? No, that's something else. You know, on and on and on and on and on. So that's the committee that said, well, let's mortgage and charge and pledge. Let's put all three in. Yeah, brilliant, lunch. It's rubbish. It's rubbish. It's a legal impossibility. So one of the problems we've got with this is one of the key ways of protecting yourself against the failure of your transaction is to use either the credit support deed or the credit support annex, and yet it has this stupid term at its heart that you mortgage, charge and pledge. Yeah, the emotion my voice is going. One or the other. You've got to pick one of those. And why not a trust? Where the hell are the trusts going, all this? So there are these logical... So one of the great shortcomings is just stupidities in the draft. I think that's the most egregious. And that's the one that's supposed to protect you if something goes wrong and it doesn't make sense. So you're back in the kind of problem we had with Don King and Frank Warren when we did that in Property 2 early on, of the parties not making it clear, is this a trust or a partnership or what? And Mr Justice Lightman says, I've no idea what this is because the parties haven't described it properly. It's the same problem here. It just doesn't make literal legal sense. We're trying to reduce risks using this, and in fact we're just creating entirely novel problems. I've been barking on about this for years, so I'm not the only one. It's just wrong. Just wrong, bad, failed, never mind get a third. You know, Isda, naughty bad. As a friend of mine says to a dog, naughty bad. Back in your bed. The Isda only deals with corporate context. A good example of its shortcoming, apart from the fact that it's a standard and it doesn't deal with any specific situation, is that it assumes that everybody's a company. It forgets about pension funds being trusts, unit trusts being trusts. What about the partnerships? What about limited liability partnerships? There are all kinds of clever little investment funds. Most jurisdictions have got esoteric little models for investment activity in their own jurisdictions. None of those things are catered for in the standard documentation at all. So there's language, for example, about what happens if there's some reconstruction or merger of the parties. And you think, well, those aren't the issues in relation, for example, to a trust. The problem with a trust is not that there is a corporate reconstruction or something of that sort. It's what if one of the beneficiaries exercises their Saunders and Vautier rights and takes all the property out of the trust? It's still the same trust, it's just it's worthless. You need to have a whole other perspective as to what are the risks in relation to that particular entity if you want your contract to work. If it's a partnership, again, your problem would be, what if one of the partners leaves and takes their capital with them? That's not a reconstruction or something as you understand it in company law terms. So the contract just doesn't deal with that at all. The bankruptcy provision, which is the key provision, doesn't cover what if your trust has no assets left in it. What if your partnership has no assets left in it? None of that stuff is covered in this documentation. So again, because it focuses only on corporate contexts, even then it doesn't cover all the risks, but it's not covering anything like the full range of problems that are out there in the world.
Termination and loss. Quickly onto termination and loss. Look, on page 119, you've got some stuff from the agreement in your handout. Who knew? Let's just go back ever so slightly onto page 118 and just explain what's going on here. We did cover all this stuff when we talked about master agreements a million years ago.
So if you want more detail than you need, you can always go back and have a listen to that stuff on the lectures. It's all there on the internet. How exciting. How modern. Or postmodern, who knows. The idea is, if you breach any of the, under heading 9, the bottom of page 118, if you breach any of the events of default or the termination events that are set out in the master agreement, then that brings the termination provisions into play. Okay?
So just to have a look at what's on this list, the events of default. Under heading 9, the events of default are the things which lead to a compulsory termination of the master agreement. If one of the parties fails to pay, over on page 119, if there's a breach of contract, a failure of a guarantee, so one of these credit support things turns out not to work, for example, if one of the parties has made a misrepresentation of a material kind, if there's a cross default, we remember cross default when we did loans. Yeah? What if there's a default under some of the other parties' lending or other derivatives transactions? If there's a default in a derivatives transaction with somebody else, that will constitute a breach of your own transaction and let you get out of your transaction straight away. What if your credit worth deteriorates, corporate restructuring or bankruptcy? Bless you. In those situations, what happens is automatically we start under heading 11, the early termination procedure. And the basic idea is this. If we trigger the termination procedure, then we are supposed to look at all of the derivatives outstanding between the parties that have been brought under this transaction. Now remember, in practice, a lot of these transactions are never documented. So in theory, they don't fall under this procedure. I think actually in practice a lot of banks try and pretend they do. But in theory, because if you don't have a contract signed in relation to each individual trade, they shouldn't fall under this transaction. Because it's the confirmations that are linked to the master agreement, not the trade itself necessarily. So that's a real problem. Anyway, the idea is you look across all of your outstanding transactions. You work out at today's date, the valuation date, who owes what to whom. Across thousands of different transactions. And then you come eventually to one single net figure across all of those deals as to who owes what to whom, having set all of those amounts off. That's why the closeout netting provision is so important and yet so sadly lacking in most of these transactions, and because that's what you need to do if there's an insolvency. You want to come down to one single final figure. And the problem is, how do we do that? What's our mechanism for doing that? Because obviously if you just go and ask some guy or you do it yourself, you're probably going to come to a really partial valuation. Remember, Lehman, one of the things we criticised Lehman for was that it valued its assets at a much, much higher level than other people thought its assets were worth. So how do we find an answer for this? Well, page 119, the 1992 version of this agreement had something called market quotation, which we set out there at huge and gratuitous detail. Let's make life simple. A market quotation means that you go out and you ask a given number of people who are what are called reference market makers. Yes? You go out and ask, usually it's 3, sometimes it's 5, depending on how people structure their document. You go out and ask people who make a market in this, you go out and ask 5 of them, how would you value these transactions? Usually you ignore the highest and the lowest and take an average of the 3 in the middle. Okay? So you go and ask people what their value is. This is all built not around law, therefore,
What we said about the Banking Act 2009, this is all built around how other bankers see this stuff.
And everyone assumed that bankers would then be able to take a nice, sensible view on who owes what to whom. Before, I would suggest Peregrine Fixed Income and Robinson on page 120. We can make a long story very short. What happened in Peregrine and Robinson? Robinson run a large number of department stores in Thailand. And they went bankrupt. And so the question was asked, we've got to terminate all these derivatives transactions. What do you think they're worth, reference market makers? Yeah? Your banks who deal in these products, how would you value these things now? What do you think is the close-out value of all of this? And they said, yeah, well, Robinson's bankrupt, yeah? Yes. Well, Infinity, they're bankrupt. We're not going to deal with them. Entering into another transaction with guys who you know can't pay you, they've got to pay me Infinity pounds even to get out of bed in the morning. Yeah, nothing. A million, I don't know. Gajillions, gajillions, made up numbers. There is no way you'll do this deal. So suddenly we realised, actually, you can't get a market value in a sensible way if one of you's gone bust, because no one will deal with them. It's the same product as the same problem we found with the financial crisis. When there is no market and no one will lend to one another, you know, there is no effective interest rate. These products have no value because no one will buy them. If you're trying to buy or sell your house, it's worth nothing until you find someone that's actually prepared to pay something for it. You assume what your estate agent tells you is the real value, but it's not. Until you find some mug that's prepared to put up with your next door neighbours, you know, and give you real money, that's its value. Yeah. Plus the existential freedom of getting out of the place at last. So in Peregrine and Fixed Income, we get an idea that we have to act with reasonableness. We have to act with a commercial reasonableness when we reach our quantification of these things, but that doesn't answer the question, what's reasonable? Also very odd in that case that we start looking at cases like Wednesbury as to what reasonable means. And you think, why are we borrowing from public law? We also have other problems with loss. Well, the other way is that you just say you're entitled to recover your loss. The trouble is in lots of cases like Australia, New Zealand Bank and Société Générale, at first instance, and at the Court of Appeal, and also Climate Benson and Birmingham City Council. As we know, when you create derivatives transactions, that creates an exposure. You have a risk that market will move against you. So you go out and you buy a hedge yourself, which you hope will negate the risk of your loss under that derivative. We talked about this last time. I entered a deal with you. I immediately think, well, that might lose me £100,000, so I'm going to go back and buy a hedge that I think will make me £100,000, it will move in a different direction. And thus the mathematicians say, well, this mathematically will cancel that out, and we hope the world stays predictable. Yeah? In cases like ANZ and SocGen, and also Climate Benson and Birmingham City Council, which wasn't cited in ANZ, which is a real shame, the courts have held that you can't take into account the loss of a hedge in deciding what your loss is. What does this mean? If I enter a derivative with you and I feel I've got an exposure at the minute, so I want to go and buy a transaction that will effectively provide me some kind of insurance against that deal going bad, I buy another derivative which I think will cancel it out. If I cancel the deal with you, I've still got that hedging transaction. I've still got that second derivative I bought to cancel out the first one. Suddenly, that's an open position, because it's not balancing off the deal I've got with you. It's simply there, and it might cause me a loss in itself. So I've got a hedge that I've got to hedge. Is this becoming painful? It is painful. Yeah? I've got to keep hedging my hedge, and then I've got to hedge my hedge and my hedge and my hedge, and suddenly that's a hell of a garden. Yeah? So if I've got an open hedge suddenly, that's a loss to me. So I want to take that into account. In terms of my total loss, that's either going to be a cancellation charge if I want to cancel that deal, or I've got to buy a brand new hedge to cancel out the first hedge. That's a loss. That's money I'm going to have to pay out. But the English High Court, the English Court of Appeal, refuses to take that into account because in ANZ, they said, we have no way of knowing whether or not that bank is acting reasonably in taking that loss of a hedge into account. You might be hedging in a stupid way. Why should your counterparty have to suffer the cost of your, could be stupidity, could be unreasonableness, yeah, could be your being overly risky, excited, whatever the word is I'm trying to think of there, I can't think of it. You know,
How do we know you're acting in a, quote, commercially reasonable manner, says the court. So the thing we got there from these ISDA transactions, when they've appeared in the courts in these couple of cases, is they just haven't worked as everybody hoped. This is supposed to protect us against companies like Robinson going into insolvency. This is supposed to ensure that we can recover all of our losses if our deals have to be wound up. And apparently the contracts just aren't being put into effect the way anyone predicted. What does the market do? It redrafted market quotation and loss under a new thing called replacement value, which is the new section 14 of the ISDA Master Agreement 2002, which uses the expression, you can take into account any loss, providing you act in a third line down, commercially reasonable manner. They simply quoted from the court in ANZ, in the hope, well, if that was what was bothering the judge, if we use that language, hopefully that will be okay in the future. Otherwise, it's exactly the same provision. They've just given it another heading. It's the same thing with commercially reasonable manner stuck in the middle of it, but it's exactly the same idea. You go and take market quotations. So we haven't changed anything. We've just tried to move the deck chairs around on the Titanic in the hope that that would solve the problem, but maybe no one will notice next time. The other problem was the definition of loss in Section 14 in the 1992 agreement said amongst the losses you can take into account are the loss of a hedge. It was there in the document. The court simply ignored it. And this is something that ISDA don't like, the idea that the courts might simply ignore what's going on in these contracts. Yeah. They tend not to try and discuss this stuff. But the courts often will just say, I don't believe that, I don't think that's commercially reasonable. So this is what we're building the whole of our protection on. This idea that this contract is going to control the risks, we're all going to sign up to the same thing. It is full of holes and full of problems. As indeed the derivatives markets are full of holes and creating problems for us all. Towards the bottom of that bullet pointed list, I think there's a problem. This is meant to be self-regulation. And what's happened for so long, I think, is that self-regulation through the ISDA contract, which has huge numbers of flaws anyway, I've picked out some of the most obvious ones, I hope, is that it actually has just deterred proper regulation. It's led Alan Greenspan and people to say, let's not have regulation, let's let the markets do it themselves. After the crash, is that really supportable? And also it's led to something that I like to think of as being the privatisation of law. Because what happens in these areas, I've told you about some of the banking lawyers in these areas, they develop their own little ideas, and they just try and ignore the rest of the world outside. They don't read cases, they don't care, they're far too busy and important and rich for that. They don't care about what's happening in the law outside. They're interested in the way they do it themselves, using their own standard market contract. And what they're also trying to do with self-regulation then, is to get out of positivist law, if you want to put it in those terms. If positivism is about a sovereign law issuing a series of commands that we're all required to obey, what they're trying to say is, no, we operate under our own separate code and our own separate contracts, and we're going to go and do that over here, thank you. And we're going to keep this entirely privatised within ourselves. Yeah, we're not going to, in systems theory, talk about inputs and outputs with other bits of the legal system. We want to be our own little area. We're not tied to any jurisdiction. We float, we're international. We are derivatives. If you don't like us, we'll go somewhere else. Yeah? All those hedge funds currently decamping to Switzerland. Good luck. Enjoy the skiing. You know? Off you go. I mean, how are you helping here? You've created the bubble of the crisis. Please do go away. So that's another problem with all this stuff. There's a kind of theoretical problem there as well, about a kind of reservoir of power of things being closed off. Emile Durkheim, the French sociologist, liked the idea that contracts were good because they bring people together. Actually, what contracts often also do is they separate things off in private. All of these markets are off exchange. They're very difficult to find, let alone to regulate. And these contracts actually have the effect of being a hidden reservoir of power, of knowledge, of relations that are hidden away between banks off exchange, so no one can really get at them. And that creates a problem for positivist law. How were we able to be a sovereign giving commands? We've looked at the Banking Act 2009 and how that really isn't taking control of anything like these financial crises. Instead, the crisis goes on and law just seems to stand in the distance, and there's not very much we can do. So when we talked about derivatives, we've mentioned them before, we've talked about the crash itself. And just to remind ourselves very quickly, this is kind of a 2-minute thing, what went wrong with the crash. The problem was we had all these people, the subprime people, who were being lent money in the US. They were being lent money in the US because we developed an ideology and a dream that these housing markets could only go up. We developed an idea as well that we could take all of these individual mortgages and we could package them together and make them into an individual security. And this was something that the maths was able to do. The mathematician said, oh, I know what we can do. We can package them all up together as a one-off security. Yeah. And we can sell it. We'll set up something called an SPV, a special purpose vehicle, and we'll transfer all of these mortgages into this special purpose vehicle. So we, the bank, no longer own the mortgages anymore. Instead, we've transferred that to a brand new company we've set up for the purpose. We'll have a trustee who will be in charge of overseeing how this SPV functions. So it's at arm's length from us, the bank. Yeah. The bank that's done all this, the bank that sat there on the telephone and sold all these mortgages, is then away in the background. The SPV then issues bonds to investors out there in the marketplace. And the bonds are said to be the payments of interest received from these subprime borrowers are paid straight to the SPV, and then they're divided up amongst those bondholders, however many bonds they hold. The profits, the interest rate payments, are shared out pro rata between all those bondholders. Yeah. So we've then, as the bank, we have sold through the SPV all of these mortgages off in one big lump sum, you know, billions and trillions of dollars worth of stuff sold off at once to all these investors, and what the investors are getting is, you know, the couple of thousand dollars a month that these people are paying in their mortgage repayments. Okay. The credit default swap came in there because people started to say, okay, if I'm one of these investors, I'm concerned, what if these guys don't pay? I want some insurance in case these guys don't pay, because some of my people are saying there might be trouble down the road with the American economy. So I want some insurance. And so what we do is we go and find, let's just call them a swap stealer, someone out there in the marketplace who, again, we find protection through maths. We don't need to own anything. Instead, we'll buy our insurance through using clever derivatives. The swap stealer says, you, the investors, pay me what you actually receive from the payments under the bonds from the subprime borrowers. You pay me what you actually receive. In return, I, the swap stealer, will pay you what you should have received under these mortgage payments via the bonds. And while all these subprime borrowers are actually paying their mortgages good as gold, everyone just assumed human beings always want to pay their mortgages, everyone wants to stay in their home, it'll all be alright, the house prices will keep going up, nothing will go wrong. The amount you actually receive will equal the amount you should have received, and therefore the two things will just cancel out. Yeah? That's the theory. We adjust those slightly, so the swap stealer's getting a small fee for this, and the swap stealer's thinking, I'm making money out of this, I'm getting these fees for nothing. Let's sell more of this. The bank is thinking, these things are making us a fortune, this securitization business, let's have more of those. Yeah. Brilliant, more, more, more. Swap stealers, let's have more of these. These are fees, these are huge. Lehman is huge in these markets. Selling this insurance type stuff, AIG is particularly big in this, has no idea what it's doing, but loves it. Yeah. Lehman is huge in the American real estate market as well. Then people start to think, we don't just need to do this with investors. Speculators can gamble on whether they think people will actually pay their mortgages. Yeah. We could gamble on whether a fly's going to walk up down the wall. What will we gamble on next? Oh, let's gamble on whether or not people pay their mortgages. So we can get swap stealers out here. Shall I use another colour? Would that be fun? Can we handle three colours? Is that probably okay? Last lecture, let's go mad. Get the third pen out. Yeah. The hell with it. So we get our swap stealer dealing with, let's just call them speculators. That's what they are. Yeah. You could call them parasites, but let's just call them speculators. And they're entering into exactly the same deal. The speculator will pay what they would actually receive if they were an investor. We're in a land of make-believe now. The swaps dealer pays them what they should have received if they were an investor. And basically the gamble the speculators are saying is, I bet the amount these people actually receive is less than the amount they should have received. That's the bet. Lehman, AIG, on the other side of this bet, saying, no, it'll all be fine. So when these people stop paying, yeah, let's use some red, yeah, let's kill some people. Yeah. When they stop paying, because that's what happens in the world, obviously, they'll get your mortgage, suicide, beckons, yeah. Recession, suicide rates spike. Yeah. That's the real human cost of all this crap. They stop paying, the SPV receives less money, so it pays out less than it's supposed to on the bonds. So these credit default swaps kick in. That's okay, this will be with real bonds. It's like insurance when you say, have you actually got a right in the property? You can insure your own car, you can insure your own house. The problem is these speculators out here who suddenly are receiving a fortune, because the amount they should have received is suddenly far more than the amount that's actually being received by the investors. And so that's where Lehman, AIG, all people start losing a huge amount of money, because all of this speculative gambling on how all this is going to work goes mad. And so what we've done is we've amplified the problem of poor people in the US, poor at every level, and being unable to pay mortgages that they shouldn't have been sold in the first place. That's amplified out by the credit default swaps market, people speculating on all that kind of stuff, into huge losses for the banks, and that drives Lehman Brothers into a $400 billion hole, and it's lying about $50 billion on its balance sheet and everything else. So all of this innovation, all of this maths has created an entire virtual world, which is kind of where we started this course. We started talking about Borges and his short story about how we can call a world into existence simply by writing about it and by describing it. We've called an entire universe into existence here simply by making numbers up, simply by making products up. All this artificiality, all these clever ideas where lawyers have sat down with financiers and thought, how could we structure and package this? It's all words. And yet the human cost is enormous. I mean, we can see it now in the recession. We're all going to be £30,000 each household in this country is having to pay, effectively, to try and pay off just the national debt at the minute. It's all caused by all this stuff, ultimately. You know, the ramifications are huge. And the irony is the people that got us into this are the first people to get out of it. The banks are starting to make profits again. Even Lloyds is back into profit now. And the irony is they're just rolling on ahead. And already we're starting to talk about, let's not regulate hedge funds, or we don't want to stop that kind of innovative activity. What? What? Have we forgotten all this? I mean, what have you not got? So it's this entire artificial world, and that lovely idea from David Mitchell, why can't we just put the original numbers back in? They're all made up anyway. You know, that all of this course is made up. And so what we've been trying to do through the course is to try and make up the law of finance, actually. Is to try and think about how can we take the regulatory ideas that are out there and bond them to tort law, contract law, property law, criminal law and everything else. Okay? So actually what you've been doing, whether you've wanted to or not, is something creative. It's taking all that stuff you already know and trying to develop it into a new world. And it's been fun getting to know you over a couple of years and work with you. It's a real shame this is the last one. Just as a last thing, can I wish you good luck in everything you do and offer you actual, genuine love? Thank you very much. Good luck in the exam.
Hooray. Jolly good. Go home. Chocolate holiday.